From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
It is now clear that a challenge on this scale requires greater federal authority and a broader role for the armed forces, the institution of our government most capable of massive logistical operations on a moment's notice.
As President Bush says he'll rebuild New Orleans, we'll get a report on the ground from Jeremy Scahill. We'll talk to a hip-hop activist about the crackdown in the shelters. And we'll hear the story of how an emergency medical worker was trapped not just by the hurricane, but by the police.
We asked the deputies, well, why couldn't we just cross the bridge anyway? And this is where we heard for the first time that the deputies had said to us, they said, this is not New Orleans, and they were not going to have a Superdome over here. That could only mean that if you're poor or if you're black, you're not going to get out of New Orleans.
Then a fiery debate between British MP George Galloway and writer Christopher Hitchens.
For people to start pumping out propaganda before the bodies had even been uncovered in New Orleans, saying, and to make points, demagogic often, saying they wouldn't be dead if they weren't black, about people who haven't been identified, whose parents don't know where they are. And to say this wouldn't have happened if we weren't wasting money on Arabs, that is an appeal to the most base provincial isolationist and chauvinist mentality.
And you end up an apologist and a mouthpiece for those miserable, malevolent incompetents who couldn't even pick up the bodies of their own citizens in New Orleans in the aftermath of a hurricane.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In a primetime speech from New Orleans, President Bush vowed last night the country would rebuild the city and the Gulf Coast region as part of one of the largest reconstruction efforts in history.
And all who question the future of the Crescent City need to know. There is no way to imagine America without New Orleans. And this great city will rise again.
Bush outlined a plan to offer victims of the hurricane help on taxes, housing, education, and job training. He also announced an immediate review of emergency plans for all cities and called for an expanded role of the U.S. military in times of national emergency.
It is now clear that a challenge on this scale requires greater federal authority and a broader role for the armed forces, the institution of our government most capable of massive logistical operations on a moment's notice.
While Bush spoke for nearly 30 minutes, he did not address reports. He has put his top political advisor, Karl Rove, in charge of the reconstruction effort instead of appointing an independent reconstruction czar. Critics of the decision are predicting this could result in a bonanza for contractors such as Halliburton that has ties to the White House. Halliburton has already been hired to repair damaged military bases in the region. In other news on the hurricane, the Guardian of London's reporting, the Gulf Coast region is suffering from one of the worst oil spills in the country's history. Over the past 2 weeks, a total of 6.5 million gallons of oil have leaked into the waters of the region. In addition, more than 250,000 cars were submerged underwater from the flooding, as were many gas stations. This marks the country's most severe oil spill since the Exxon Valdez went ashore in 1989, leaking 11 million gallons of oil in Alaska. The commander of the Army Corps of Engineers has admitted the government should have pre-positioned more sandbags and helicopters in the New Orleans area before Hurricane Katrina. Lieutenant General Carl Strock said this would have allowed the military to quickly repair the broken levees. More information is emerging from New Orleans over how the police are treating people accused of looting. A 73-year-old woman remains in jail on a $50,000 bond after police arrested her and accused her of looting $60 worth of sausage. At the time of her arrest, the woman, Merlene Maton, was staying in a hotel with her 80-year-old husband. She said they'd followed orders to stock up on food, had stored sausage in her car. After she took the sausage from the car, she says police handcuffed her, threw her in jail. A judge then set the bail at $50,000, 100 times the maximum $500 fine under state law for minor theft. A group of 15 families from Louisiana have filed a lawsuit in an effort to have a state court judge rule that any flooding from Hurricane Katrina be covered by a resident's homeowner policy. At a hearing Thursday, state lawmakers accused the insurance industry of shirking its responsibility to residents whose property was destroyed by the storm. Meanwhile, Fox News host Bill O'Reilly has been attempting to downplay the government's failure in helping residents of New Orleans evacuate ahead of the hurricane by claiming that many of those who stayed in the city were addicted to drugs or suffered severe emotional problems.
Many, many, many of the poor in New Orleans are in that condition. They weren't going to leave no matter what you did. They were drug addicted. They weren't going to get turned off from their source. They were thugs, whatever.
That was Bill O'Reilly speaking on his radio program, The Radio Factor. On Capitol Hill, the Senate Judicial Committee has concluded its nomination hearing for Supreme Court Chief Justice nominee John Roberts. The Judiciary Committee is expected to vote on Roberts next week. Near the end of the hearing, Roberts said, quote, "If you've looked at what I've done since I took the judicial oath, that should convince you I'm not an ideologue." On Thursday, Republican and Democratic senators called a series of witnesses to testify about Roberts' character. Longtime civil rights leader and Democratic Congress member John Lewis warned the confirmation of Roberts would be a setback to civil rights. Carol Browner, the former head of the Environmental Protection Agency under Clinton, also criticized Roberts. So did Marsha Greenberger, co-president of the National Women's Law Center. Among the witnesses who supported Roberts were former Michigan Governor John Engler, who now heads the National Association of Manufacturers. Engler said he expects Roberts would add a business-friendly voice to the court. Meanwhile, Democratic senators continue to criticize Roberts for refusing to answer dozens of questions about his judicial beliefs. The Coalition for Fair and Independent Judiciary began airing TV ads Thursday that highlight Roberts' refusal to answer many questions. This is a part of the ad.
I'm not going to comment. I can't address that. I feel the need to stay away from the discussion. I don't remember. I do not feel it appropriate for me to comment. I don't want to discuss anything. I can't answer that. I don't know what it's a matter I can't talk about. I can't answer that. I don't remember. I don't recall. I think I should stay away from discussions of particular issues. I don't think it's appropriate for me to address. I'm not going to consider issues like that. I don't want to answer. I can't comment. I don't know. That, again, is a question I can't answer. I'm not going to comment. I'm not in a position to comment. I'm not supposed to comment publicly in any way. I shouldn't.
An ad that was sponsored by the Coalition for a Fair and Independent Judiciary. The Vatican has ordered a crackdown on homosexuality at seminaries in the United States. According to the New York Times, the Vatican is sending teams of investigators to all 229 seminaries in the country in order to interview every faculty member and seminarian, as well as everyone who graduated in the last 3 years. Archbishop Edwin O'Brien is supervising the review. Last week, he told the National Catholic Register that, quote, anyone who's engaged in homosexual activity or has strong homosexual inclinations should not be admitted to a seminary. He said the restriction should even apply to men who have not been sexually active for a decade or more. The investigators will also be on the lookout for any faculty members who dissent from church teaching. The last such review began about 25 years ago and took 6 years to complete. Mitt Romney, the Republican governor of Massachusetts, has suggested law enforcement agents begin wiretapping mosques and conducting surveillance of all foreign students in the state. During a speech at the Heritage Foundation, he called on the federal government to devote far more money and attention to domestic intelligence gathering. He said, quote, "How many individuals are coming to our state and going to those institutions who've come from terrorist-sponsored states? Do we know where they are? Are we tracking them?" Romney is considered to be a likely Republican candidate for president in 2008. At the United Nations, Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez accused the United States of trying to hijack the summit of world leaders. He called upon nations to do more to tackle poverty and improve the environment. The three-day summit was set up to find new ways to tackle poverty, but the final document agreed to by UN member states saw almost every issue, from education, disease, trade, aid, and disarmament, scaled down in an attempt to produce a text all governments could endorse by the summit's end. Chavez also described the United States as a terrorist nation because it's harboring the televangelist Pat Robertson. Chavez said, quote, "He publicly asked for my assassination and he's still walking the streets. This is an international crime, terrorism, international terrorism," he said. And in other news from the United Nations, a short note written by President Bush to Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice during the UN summit is making international headlines. A Reuters cameraman snapped a photograph of Bush writing the words, "I think I may need a bathroom break. Is this possible?" The note appears on the cover of today's Times of London under the headline, "Leaked UN Memo. What did President Bush ask Condi Rice?" And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Thursday evening, President Bush addressed the nation from the devastated city of New Orleans. He spoke in Jackson Square in the heart of the French Quarter and said the rebuilding of the Gulf Coast after Hurricane Katrina will be one of the largest reconstruction projects the world has ever seen. He also acknowledged the government failed to respond adequately to the disaster. African Americans have been particularly angered by the government response to the disaster, with an overwhelming majority telling pollsters they believe help would have come quicker if so many of the people stranded had not been poor and black. Bush seemed to be responding to those charges by mentioning the role of persistent poverty in the region.
When communities are rebuilt, they must be even better and stronger than before the storm. Within the Gulf region are some of the most beautiful and historic places in America. As all of us saw on television, there's also some deep, persistent poverty in this region as well. That poverty has roots in a history of racial discrimination, which cut off generations from the opportunity of America. We have a duty to confront this poverty with bold action. So let us restore all that we have cherished from yesterday, and let us rise above the legacy of inequality. When the streets are rebuilt, there should be many new businesses, including minority-owned businesses, along those streets. When the houses are rebuilt, more families should own, not rent, those houses. When the regional economy revives, local people should be prepared for the jobs being created. Americans want the Gulf Coast not just to survive, but to thrive. Not just to cope, but to overcome. We want evacuees to come home for the best of reasons, because they have a real chance at a better life in a place they love.
President Bush speaking in New Orleans. He faced a nation at a vulnerable point in his presidency. Most Americans disapprove of his handling of the hurricane, and his job approval rating is at the lowest point of his presidency. In his speech, Bush promised to review the government response and cooperate in a congressional investigation into what went wrong. He also said a disaster on the scale of Katrina requires greater federal authority and a broader role for the armed forces.
I also want to know all the facts about the government response to Hurricane Katrina. The storm involved a massive flood, a major supply and security operation, and an evacuation order affecting more than 1 million people. It was not a normal hurricane, and the normal disaster release system was not equal to it. Many of the men and women of the Coast Guard, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, the United States military, the National Guard, Homeland Security, and state and local governments performed skillfully under the worst conditions. Yet the system, at every level of government, was not well coordinated and was overwhelmed in the first few days. It is now clear that a challenge on this scale requires greater federal authority and a broader role for the armed forces, the institution of our government most capable of massive logistical operations on a moment's notice. 4 years after the frightening experience of September the 11th, Americans have every right to expect a more effective response in a time of emergency. When the federal government fails to meet such an obligation, I, as president, am responsible for the problem and for the solution.
President Bush speaking on Thursday from New Orleans. We're now joined by Rosa Clemente. She's a Malcolm X Fellow for the Institute of the Black World and an organizer with the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. She just drove in from New Orleans. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Well, you had quite an experience for the brief time you were there. Talk about why you're there and what happened.
I mean, I felt I needed to go, particularly as a younger person of color. I think this is a watershed moment for particularly black and people of African descent in America, and I wanted to be there. I didn't want it to be filtered through anyone's eyes but my own and my partner who went down with me, Brad Young. And it's just it was my duty to be there, to be able to report back, particularly to the hip-hop generation. And I was also very upset at the low numbers of people of color journalists that I saw on the ground. And the only ones I really saw were folks from CNN and mainstream media. And as I'm a proud member of alternative and progressive media here in New York, it was my duty to be there.
So what happened when you went particularly to look at the shelters? You went where, to the
Riverside? Well, first we went to New Orleans and actually went to the convention center. And, you know, just saw real estate speculators there and Blackwater mercenaries protecting property, and didn't realize that the Marriott and the Wyndham Hotel were right across the convention center, and began to ask the question, why weren't those hotels taken over as eminent domain? You know, that's the question I had. If someone can take my private property for to build a highway or a medical facility, why were these hotels not opened to let these people not languish in what can only need to be described as a living hell? And to see the militarization. We then went to Algiers and spent the day with Malik Rahim. Could not leave because of the curfew, and that was a first experience for me. It was an experience to have an M16 pointed at my car. And from...
What do you mean?
When we got on I-10 West, we went to a military checkpoint, and when we pulled up, three of the National Guards just had M16s pointed at the front of the car and the side door and the side door. The two front doors. And then we went to the next military checkpoint, and they told us we could not go in at all. And we snuck in, and we got on Canal Street, and we worked our way through that whole area. And we then went to Algiers again to spend the day with Malik Rahim and also see the levee and see what's going on with that. And to see the amazing work that Malik Rahim and indie media folks are doing by setting up a command center. It was amazing to be there to see that being built.
And I encourage people to go to our website, democracynow.org. We also went with Malik, a community organizer in the Algiers neighborhood, to right to the health center, which was around the corner. It's closed, the Arthur Mundy Health Center, but in the driveway has been a dead body for 2 weeks. Yes. And as he was telling us, that he's told every level of authority concerned about disease, the disrespect to the body, he's been there since the day of the hurricane. Every level of that authority drove by, and we went up to them and asked them, there's a dead body here. Will you be picking it up? The Louisiana State Police, the New Orleans Police, the National Guard, the Army, the 1st Cav, the Department of Homeland Security, an ambulance drove by, and yet this has been going on for 2 weeks.
Yeah. I mean, I think the one thing that struck me was the smell, and when I realized that it's the smell of death in the air of New Orleans, and that was, it was just shocking, because I've only kind of seen that on TV, right, and when people make that face, but and we saw things that looked like body parts, but of course I just couldn't look, and but it didn't look, it looked like human body parts that had been mutilated in the garbage cans behind the convention center. And as of Monday, when we looked in the convention center, you could see the remnants of everything, and just, it's just horrific, just to see that. So Malik had told us about that dead body that I think was finally picked up.
Oh, really? Well, yeah. That would have been in the last few days. Talk about the shelter where people who've been evacuated are staying, where you tried to document.
Yeah, we then went to the Baton Rouge River Center, which is the largest shelter in Louisiana, 7 miles away from Governor Blanco's mansion. She has not visited there. We were asking residents, how many times has the governor come here to visit? And they said not one time. There's about 4,000 people in that shelter. It's supposed to be, quote, one of the best-run American Red Cross shelters. It can only be described as a prison. Everyone we talked to in there said it was a prison-like facility. There's a you have to go through metal detectors to get in. There's a curfew. When we did get in there and had registered earlier with the Red Cross as media, we were then stopped. The National Guard let us in, and us being someone that was traveling with us, a lawyer, and the videographer, Brad Young. And when we got in there, the National Guard let us in, But then the Baton Rouge Police Department says something to the National Guard. Then the National Guard say, you can't come in. You're not media. What do you mean I'm not media? Here's my press pass. Well, you're not the media I know. And I said, who do I talk to? And they said an American Red Cross volunteer. They sent someone over, and the American Red Cross volunteer said, you're over time. Interviews can only happen up until 6 p.m. I said, I called the Red Cross, and in fact, I see CNN in here with a camera. So what's going on? So we were audioing. You know, I had my mini disc on, and Brad had his camera on. And then it was the Baton Rouge police officer who said, turn your equipment off. And we said, we're not turning our equipment off until we're told by someone from the American Red Cross, you don't run this shelter, you're here to enforce the law. He said, I'm here to do whatever I want, turn it off. We refused to. He then grabbed Brad, threw him over the table, and pulled out the handcuffs and went to arrest him. Something ensued in that point. I was not watching. I was more mini-discing the kind of chaos, because then the people coming in started to kind of stop and say, what's going on? Why can't they videotape? And people were noticing, well, they're the only black people here. Why are you not stopping those other people on the corner right here, the CNN crew? And Brad got escorted out along with the lawyer that was with me. I was left there. The officer said, I want your tape. Why do you want my tape? He said, because you said my name into the tape. I said, your name is public information. He said, you're slandering me. Give me your tape. He went to grab my mini disc, and I backed up. And he said, you're under arrest. I said, am I being detained? He said, no, you're under arrest. He then begins to call for his backup. And I said, well, what are you going to do? He goes, come over here. I said, you're going to have to grab me, and you're going to have to you're going to have to put handcuffs on me. He said, give me your mini disc. I'm not going to ask you again. So I popped the tape out. I put it in my pants, and I handed him the mini disc. I said, here's the mini disc. You didn't ask for the tape. If you want the tape, you're going to have to strip search me in public. He called for backup again. I said, am I under arrest? You're under arrest. Can I leave? You're under arrest. The lieutenant came with three other people, I guess more superior to him, and they whispered, had a little conversation. The lieutenant goes, who are you with? I said, I'm a reporter with Pacifica Radio. I'm also corresponding for the Bev Smith Show, and I gave him the rundown. And he said, let me see your press credential. I showed it to him. He said, on behalf of the Baton Rouge Police Department, Ms. Clemente, we apologize. You're free to go. We then went outside and stayed until curfew, which is 10 p.m., and got some amazing interviews with some young men who actually said, I'd rather be in prison because at least in prison I have information. When we asked them what that meant, what it meant is that they don't get papers. For 4,000 people, there's only 3 TVs. For 4,000 people, there's only 3 computers, and they can only go on the computer not to access websites but to download FEMA forms. Then they download these FEMA forms, but many people are illiterate. There's no one there to help them. There were no Spanish language translators, although there's a sizable Latino population in there. There's a Filipino and Vietnamese population, no translators for them. So they have other people kind of looking out for them. They're giving kids, the Church of Scientology is the biggest organization in there. There was about 40 of them. What they do is every hour they go and give kids lollipops and little juices and potato chips. We asked the young men, what kind of food are you getting? They get a bagel and orange juice in the morning. They get a peanut butter and jelly sandwich during the day. And they get ravioli with some type of white sauce, a scoop of corn, and a piece of bread. Some of the young men are not allowed to wear sneakers because if they're already labeled as a, quote, gang member, they're not allowing them to wear sneakers. They have to wear what we call prison slippers. I mean, just Amy just goes on and on and on.
Well, if people want to see your reports, you can go to Rosa's website at rosaclementi.com. Rosa, thanks for being with us.
Amy, thank you so much for having me.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we get a report from the ground in New Orleans, Baton Rouge area with Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill. Then we'll hear a fiery debate between, well, MP, British MP George Galloway, and the writer, Christopher Hitchens. Stay with us.
All you could see, all the people hit the road. Everyone except the number of those who could not go. Everyone except the numbers of those who could not go. And then the winds, the waves and rain. Then the winds and waves and rain pounded all along the coastline and the walls of Pontchartrain. Pounded all along the coastline and the walls of Pontchartrain. Till the levees they give way, till the levees they give way. They pray the numbers that they'd be spared on that sad day. How they pray the numbers that they'd be spared on that sad day.
Stefan Smith singing When the Storm Came Rushing In. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Well, the Central Business District and the historic French Quarter were neighborhoods in New Orleans that saw relatively little damage this weekend. The city will start reopening those areas and a few others for businesses and residents to return. However, many are concerned about what will happen to the city's poor black residents whose neighborhoods were mostly destroyed. Democracy Now! Correspondent Jeremy Scahill has been in Louisiana this past week. He's been looking into how the city's changed to a militarized zone and what that means for the residents who left. He joins us on the phone from Baton Rouge. Welcome, Jeremy.
It's good to be with you, Amy.
Can you talk about what you have been seeing, who you've been talking to this week?
Well, I mean, in the days that have passed, the week or so since you were here this past weekend, we've seen a real increase in the militarization of the city. It's turned into a much greater state of lockdown. You have more military checkpoints set up. You have less of a civilian presence in large parts of the city and much more of a military presence. I mean, in fact, I still have only seen one FEMA vehicle the entire time I've been here, and that it wasn't even staffed. It was just a FEMA vehicle that was parked on a median near the Hyatt Hotel, where the main headquarters is of the so-called Operational Emergency Command, where you have the military and various branches of government coordinating their so-called disaster response. But there are soldiers all over the city, and what's incredible is that you see them doing almost nothing. They're either just standing around or sitting around, but there's very little work being done by the military. You do see units like the 82nd Airborne patrolling the street, and it looks sort of like the aftermath of a massacre or a war zone where you have soldiers patrolling around. We've also seen a tremendous increase in the number of private security contractors who have arrived on the scene. It's interesting, Amy, we talked earlier this week about the Blackwater mercenaries, and I talked about my hour-long conversation with them when they had first arrived here, and I reported that they were saying they were on contract with the Department of Homeland Security. This, of course, was denied by the federal government. Well, now they've been forced to admit, the federal government, that Blackwater is on federal contract with FEMA to protect, so-called protect, its rebuilding or reconstruction efforts in Louisiana. This is just one of the firms that is getting now federal money. And I think that these firms view the current situation in Louisiana as the biggest pot of federal money to put their hands into since the occupations of Iraq and Afghanistan. I also, 2 days ago, had a chance to meet one of the wealthiest citizens of New Orleans, F. Patrick Quinn III. He is the single greatest owner of private rooms in New Orleans. He's the he owns the largest hotel chain in the state of Louisiana, Decatur Hotels. He is currently, he told me, his hotels are being looked at by FEMA to house their workers for the long haul of this so-called reconstruction. And so I was talking to him and his head of security. And after he sped off in his SUV, about 30 Mexican workers came out of his hotel, and one of his security guards said that they had been brought in from Texas. And, in fact, another news report about Patrick Quinn said that he had brought in workers from Texas as well. So we have the reality of these shelters full of people wanting work, and then you see Mexican workers being brought in from Texas, and when they're done doing this dirty work, they're then put under the back of trucks, piled into trucks, and then they go to wherever it is that they're staying. And this man, Patrick Quinn, bidding for these contracts where FEMA is going to potentially come in and rent out hundreds and hundreds of rooms in his hotel as other businesses are struggling to simply stay alive or to scramble to get federal money to rebuild. He stands to gain a tremendous amount of money from these lucrative federal contracts. And it must be noted that he's a major contributor to the Republican Party. In fact, his wife was just elected in a special election to the state Senate. Her name is Julie Quinn. And Amy, he has brought in security from a company called BATS in Alabama, Bodyguard and Tactical Services. And when I was talking to his head of security, I told him I was from New York, and he said, oh, I've been to New York during the Daily News strike, referring to the strike at the New York Daily News. And Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez, a New York Daily News columnist, was one of the leaders of that strike. And I told him that Juan Gonzalez was a colleague of mine, and he told me that he had, quote, spiked Juan Gonzalez's car. He said he had put sugar in the gas tank of Juan Gonzalez's car. The man's name is Michael Montgomery, and he is the head of security for BATS Security in Alabama, bragging about spiking the car of Juan Gonzalez and other strike leaders during the New York Daily News strike. He now is heading up security for the hotels of the Decatur hotel chain owned by Patrick Quinn, a major businessman here in New Orleans, his wife, a Republican state senator. And this is just one example of cronyism that we see here on the ground, where these wealthy Republican contributors are being considered now for these tremendous federal contracts.
We're talking to Jeremy Scahill. He is a Democracy Now! Correspondent on the ground now, New Orleans, Baton Rouge. You also spent time at the jail, which is the converted Greyhound train station. Is that right? Run by the head of the Angola prison, the largest prison in this country.
Right. One of the things that happened, and it was something we're going to be looking at very closely on Democracy Now! Continue to in the coming weeks, and that is what happened to the prisoners who were inside the Orleans Parish Prison, as well as other facilities. As prisoners now start to get released, they're going to be telling their stories. And one of the makeshift places that they took people was they converted the Greyhound and Amtrak terminals into prisons where they brought people. And so they're using the concrete areas where the buses would pull in to house prisoners, and then they ship them off to various parts of the country. And in that downtown area, it's really just sort of desolate and abandoned. And now they call it Camp Greyhound, where they're running that prison. And this is a major question that still looms in the air here, and that is, what is going to happen to all of these people who were arrested the night before the hurricane struck, for instance, on minor violations, who should have been processed in a matter of hours and then released, and they've been shipped all over the country. So you have now lawyers scrambling to try to track down where people are and make sure that they can get out. But one of the great concerns right now in New Orleans, as businessmen talk openly of wanting to see New Orleans change, to change it completely in a demographic sense, geographically, politically, racially, you have this overt rhetoric. Well, as residents of New Orleans come back in and they try to go back to the apartments that they were renting or the houses that they were renting, they face a city that has very repressive laws that do not protect tenants. And so you have an overt agenda to try to change the racial makeup of the city, the economic makeup of the city. And you have these very wealthy people hiring private mercenary types to guard their property and their interest. And you also have the National Guard and the Army inside of the city now. And so the potential for conflict with residents coming back in is very great. And a lot of people are very concerned now with this martial law still in effect, with the military curfew still in effect, that is going to remain as people come back and live here. Because it's one thing to have martial law when you have a depopulated city. It's another thing to have it when you have people in who want to go about the business of rebuilding their lives, particularly when they are being told by very wealthy, powerful people backed up by men with guns that they are not welcome in the city that they've lived in their whole life. We have a potential, I think, for serious overt conflict, hot conflict here in New Orleans as people start coming back in.
And Jeremy, we all went over to Southern University, Black College in Baton Rouge, where some of the evacuees had gathered to talk about how they can be a part of the planning for the reconstruction. Very difficult because the most disempowered people have been sent off to areas all over the country, from Utah to Cape Cod, often not knowing when they were getting on a bus or perhaps a plane where they were actually going to land. While they were sent off there, do they have the money even to return, let alone be a part of how this city will be rebuilt?
Right. I was just watching a CNN, and they were interviewing a guy. They're calling him the Pied Piper of Hurricane Katrina, a guy from Ohio who's come to the Houston Astrodome to recruit 100 people who had left New Orleans to try to bring them to settle in Ohio. I mean, what they're really trying to do is to settle the poor and the African-American populations of New Orleans elsewhere, and to make New Orleans a nice white city for white rich businessmen. And there's no other way to put it. That is exactly what we're seeing right now. They want to take areas, for instance, like the Ninth Ward, and turn them into big, you know, Walmart-type neighborhoods. In fact, we heard Mayor Nagin talk yesterday about how one of the first things they want to do is set up a gigantic Walmart so that people returning can have a place to shop in New Orleans. I mean, this hurricane is the greatest thing to happen to the Walmart since the Superstore. And this is a very serious, racist series of actions that we're seeing here right now. And this has everything to do with class. It has everything to do with race. And it's very, very frightening. And, yes, we attend a conference where grassroots activists are talking about a plan for rebuilding New Orleans. But it's on right now, and they're not a part of it. And the people that are a part of it are old-time Louisiana white Republican families working in conjunction with their friend, Mayor Ray Nagin, and there's no other way to put it. They love Ray Nagin. He's pro-business. He's their guy. I mean, look at the comments of James Rice, a local businessman who is one of the leaders of the private Audubon Place, the gated community, the only privately owned street in the city of New Orleans. He told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "Those who want to see this city rebuilt want to see it done in a completely different way, demographically, geographically, and politically. I'm not just speaking for myself here. The way we've been living is not going to happen again, or we're out." Well, James Rice has brought in Israeli paramilitaries to guard his facility. It's an Israeli company that brags about having former members of the Shin Bet, the GSS, the Israeli Defense Forces. He has brought them in, and I was talking to them in front of his property. Some of them participated in the Israeli invasion of Lebanon, and these are guys now who are patrolling outside on St. Charles Avenue in front of Audubon Place, and potentially will come into conflict with residents of New Orleans. What on earth are Israeli paramilitaries doing on the streets of New Orleans? These are the questions that people need to ask right now, defending a man like James Rice, who has called basically for the poor to not be allowed back into New Orleans.
And Jeremy, as people are, some people, slowly making their way back, reports of the spraying of the city with pesticide that's never been used on urban populations, and they're mixing it with blue dyes so that the pilots can see where they have sprayed. I think it's called something like NALID. Have you seen planes dispersing this pesticide?
Well, I remember the other night you called me and you alerted me to this, and I just that day had seen what I thought were sort of spy drones, because really what we've seen here is sort of some people are calling it New Iraq instead of New Orleans because of all of the various forces, the Halliburtons, the KBRs, the Blackwaters that are here now. It's the connections to Iraq are so incredible, and the same looters who have raided the federal funds in Iraq, the U.S. federal funds in Iraq, are now looting federal funds here in New Orleans. And, yes, I saw those drones flying overhead, and I'm concerned, very concerned, of the toxic waste that they're now dumping on the city, in addition to the horribly unsafe waters that flow through the city and continue to flow through this city.
Jeremy Scahill, thank you for being with us. Jeremy speaking to us from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, a chilling tale of an emergency worker who was trapped not just by the hurricane, but by the police. And then we'll hear an excerpt of a fiery debate between British MP George Galloway and writer Christopher Hitchens. Stay with us.
Years and years of warning, no evacuation plan. It was just if the waters rose. Get out if you can. There were no buses. No one chartered any trains. There was no plan to rescue all of those who would remain. All the people with no money. All the people with no wheels. All of those who didn't hotwire one that they could steal. Thousands and thousands of people abandoned by the state. Abandoned by their country. Just left to meet their fate. New Orleans. New Orleans. New Orleans. And the people died. Then they died some more. They drowned inside their attics. An army of the poor. An army of the destitute who couldn't get away. And the world will remember these sad and awful days when people shouted from their houses, dying on their roofs. When people came to find them, they were turned back by the troops. They died there with no water. They died there in the heat. They were shot down by the soldiers for trying to find some food to eat. New Orleans. New Orleans. New Orleans. Now the city is in ruins. A massive toxic sea scattered through the nation. 500,000 refugees. Here we are. In the richest country on the earth, where the color of your skin determines what your life is worth, where oil is the king.
New Orleans, David Rovics here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Wednesday night, a fiery debate at Brook College here in New York. It pitted British anti-war MP George Galloway against the author Christopher Hitchens. They went at it for 2 hours. I moderated the debate, and today we thought on this special that we're doing with Pacifica radio stations around the country that we're broadcasting on over 350 radio and TV stations, we would play an excerpt of the debate that related to Hurricane Katrina. They were speaking before a sold-out crowd of more than 1,000 people. I asked them about the impact of Iraq on New Orleans. Christopher Hitchens responded first, but this was a question.
Christopher Hitchens, what about the costs of this war at home? I've just come from New Orleans. Across the political spectrum, you're hearing more and more dissent and criticism of what's happening in Iraq because of what didn't happen in New Orleans, the lack of National Guard in Mississippi and Louisiana, the weapons, rather the vehicles that were needed that weren't there. So two questions on that. Yeah. What about the cost here at home with the Hurricane Katrina and the lack of response? And if we see clearly, because the reporters are unembedded here. The troops weren't in New Orleans, and they really presented the pictures. If we see clearly the way the U.S. responded here in terms of rebuilding or not, what makes you think the U.S. is any better in Iraq?
Well, I would caution people from adopting a zero-sum mentality in this respect. I had the opportunity to speak with a close associate of Lieutenant General Steve Plum some time ago, said that he had, before the situation became as dire as it did, had been able to call up the Secretary of Defense and say, I have 200,000 troops you can have any time. But the question is, where's the order going to come from? The President can't, as you know, Amy, cannot order American troops into action in a State of the Union. he has to be asked by the governor for this to happen. And the governor has to admit, well, I'm sorry, it's in the Constitution. It is in the Constitution. Unless you want...
Troops into Iraq.
Unless you want to invoke the Insurrection Act, which hasn't been, I think, invoked until, since the Civil War. So the fact of the matter is there were more than enough soldiers. They just weren't given the orders in time. And that's a matter of future. But as soon as they made their appearance, didn't everything start to look a lot better? Aren't you proud of General Honoré? Are you not proud that a man born into segregation and discrimination is leading really hard, professional, tough, generous, brave men and women in uniform for the recovery of New Orleans, and all the time has a son in Fallujah and seems to think he can manage both? I think it's hugely to the credit of the United States Armed Forces that they would consider it ignoble to abandon their commitments in Sadr City and in Halabja and elsewhere. Ignoble and parochial and provincial. Now, Mr. Galloway came a little near the knuckle a moment ago and decided to overlook it. He said what I said was bordering on racist. I really feel I'm entitled to ask him to withdraw that imputation. I think that's an opprobrious thing to say, but I will have to add that for people to start pumping out propaganda before the bodies had even been uncovered in New Orleans saying, and to make points, demagogic often, saying they wouldn't be dead if they weren't black, about people who haven't been identified yet, whose parents don't know where they are. And to say this wouldn't have happened if we weren't wasting money on Arabs, that is an appeal to the most base provincial isolationist and chauvinist mentality. You're on TV.
Galloway.
You're all on
Amy,
TV.
I'm so glad Mr. Hitchens gave that answer. You see, this is where it ends, isn't it? You start off being the liberal mouthpiece of one of the most reactionary governments this country has ever seen on the subject of war. You say you've got your own liberal reasons for doing so, and you end up an apologist and a mouthpiece for those miserable, malevolent incompetents who couldn't even pick up the bodies of their own citizens in New Orleans in the aftermath of a hurricane. That's where it ends, Hitchens. That's where it ends. You end up a mouthpiece and an apologist for the Bush family, whose matriarch. You want to talk about racism? What about Barbara Bush? What about Barbara Bush, who took a look at the poor, huddled masses in the Astrodome and told us they'd never had it so good, who told us they were better off than they'd ever been? Underprivileged people now in an Astrodome, the only problem with whom, she said, was that so many of them wanted to stay in Texas. You know, Hitchens, you're a court jester. You're a court jester. Not at Camelot, like other ridiculous former liberals before you, but at the court of the Bourbon Bushes. Barbara Bush, the Marie Antoinette of modern day American politics.
Well, I think I have to say a quick word, Amy, if I may. I mean, this is all good knockabout stuff, but I must say Mrs. Bush Sr. does remind me of, I think it was Lady Diana Cooper, who was once stopped outside Claridge's Hotel in London as she was waiting under the umbrella for the Daimler to be brought round after a ball. Ragged man approached her and said, "Ma'am," he said, "I haven't eaten for 3 days." She said, "Well, you're very foolish then. You must try, if necessary. You must force yourself, if necessary." It's called a tumbril remark in some circles. Yes, I don't know where the Marie Antoinette cake shop was in the Astrodome, but if you notice, I didn't say that I defended the president's record on this, and I've written very critically about it already for all of you to read in Slate magazine. What I will not have said is that we should go to a refugee woman in Biloxi and say to her, do you realize the Arabs have stolen the money that should have come to you? And we have no right to put the poor against each other in that way and to betray our internationalism, and we have no right whatever to insult the tremendous performance of the United States Armed Forces once they were put into action. And I will add one more thing. The 82nd Airborne and the 1st Air Cavalry, so far from being distracted by Iraq, have learned in Iraq matters of civil reconstruction, water distribution, purification, cultural thought, that have been extremely useful to them in New Orleans. I would advise you not to jeer these men and women while you're being televised, ladies and gentlemen. I would advise you not to do it.
Vanity Fair writer Christopher Hitchens debating British MP George Galloway. George Galloway's new book that he's come to tour the United States with is called Mr. Galloway Goes to Washington. And you can find out his tour around the country at MrGallowayGoesToWashington.com. He's headed to Toronto, Madison, Chicago, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles. He will end up in Washington, D.C. for the big anti-war march on September 24th. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we wrap up with an emergency worker who just recently came out of New Orleans. Yesterday, I spoke to Lori Beth Slonsky of San Francisco, retired paramedic from the San Francisco Fire Department. She was in New Orleans attending a conference with her partner when Hurricane Katrina hit. She was fortunate enough to be staying in a hotel in the French Quarter for the first few days, but then she and Larry Bradshaw, her partner, were forced to leave when conditions worsened. She tells the story from there.
Now it's day four, and the hotels had completely run out of fuel for the generator and food and water. And sanitation, even in this very fancy hotel, had become dangerously abysmal. And it seemed like our only choice was to go to the convention center. And as we left the hotel, we came across the National Guard, and this is where they told us that we couldn't go to the Superdome nor the convention center, and they didn't have any suggestions where we should go, and they also said we should have gotten out sooner. And no, they didn't have any food, and no, they didn't have any water to spare. And then the next thing we came across was the police command center, and this is at Harrods on Canal Street, and we were told the same thing, that we were on our own, and they had no place to suggest where we should go, and they didn't have any food, but they did give us four small bottles of water to share among the probably 200 folks that had left the hotel and the downtown tourist-type folks. That's what they had to give us, was four small bottles of water to spare. So right across the street from this police command center is this amphitheater-type place, and we thought the best thing to do is just go ahead and camp across the street from the police command center, because we thought, well, we'd be visual to the media, and we'd have some sort of a protection. And before we got too comfy, the police commander came up to us and said that we needed to go to the bridge because there were going to be buses waiting there to take us out of the city. And, you know, this crowd of 200 that had left the hotel in the downtown area, we just let out a big old cheer. But Larry called everyone back and said to the police officer and to the folks that, you know, we've been given so much misinformation, and was he sure that there were buses? And I have to tell you, Amy, that he looked at us directly, and he said, I swear to you that the buses are there. So we group of about 200 people set off to the bridge, and I have to say we must have looked like quite a determined tourists with our little roll-top suitcases following behind us, and we passed near the convention center, and locals asked us where we were going, and we told them the great news, how the police commander said that there was going to be buses at the bridge, so, you know, families grabbed their few belongings, and we all started marching up toward the bridge, and our numbers doubled and probably doubled again. We were probably about 600, 700, 800 people. Just, it seemed like a lot of people. So it started to rain, and even though it started to pour down rain, it didn't dampen our spirits at all. We felt like, God, we have a way out of here on day four. And As we approached, there were armed Gretna deputies, and they had formed a line at the foot of the bridge. And before we were even close enough to cross, they shot guns over our heads. They fired guns over our heads. And this group of families, and we had disabled people, children, tourists, I mean, just everyone. We just all scattered in all sorts of directions. And then everybody was like in their own small little groups and milling around, you know, what to do next. And this is when Larry approached the Gretna deputies, and you know, he had his badge, his San Francisco Fire Department badge, and he had his hands up and asked if he could approach. And he was able to engage the deputies in some conversation. And Larry told them that we were told by the police command post that we needed to come here to the bridge because they were going to get on buses. And the deputy said that the police commander had apparently lied to us, and there were, in fact, no buses that were going to take us out of New Orleans. So we asked the deputies, well, why couldn't we just cross the bridge anyway? And this is where we heard for the first time that the deputies had said to us, they said, this is not New Orleans, and they were not going to have a Superdome over here, meaning, I guess, in Gretna or Algiers or across the bridge. And if you looked at the group that was remaining in our little group, I mean, you could only look at us and see that since predominantly everyone was African-American or a person of color, except for Larry and me and the other gal we were with, that it could only mean that if you're poor or if you're black, you're not going to get out of New Orleans.
They set up an encampment with a group of people, thought they were protected near a bridge, but the police came again and forced them to disperse. Then Lori Beth Slonsky talked about this whole discussion of looting during the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. I asked Lori Beth what she saw take place at the Walgreens near her hotel.
Our Hotel Monteleone had a little, you could look over and you could see the Walgreens because it was across the street from each other. And what you would see were people going in they would take food and they would take water, and you could see people coming out with Pampers. And then the police would arrive with their sirens blaring and they would chase everybody away. And we just watched this go on for hours, this sort of cat and mouse game of people going in and getting necessities and getting out. And the other thing that kind of amazed me is I did have, I met someone who did go into that Walgreens, and I said, you know, what was it like? You know, what did it look like inside? And she said, it was so surreal and bizarre because on one hand you could see all the makeup still on the shelves, but all where the milk and the dairy products that Walgreens does carry in their little cold containers was all gone, and it just looked like the people were going after what they needed for basic necessities, and they were sharing it to people who walked by. The police would show up, they would drive up really fast with their sirens blaring, and then everybody would scatter and run away, and then the police would leave and go on to wherever else they were going. And then apparently they must have gotten reports again, and they would screech back up and do the same thing, and we saw that a couple of times.
Lori Beth Slonsky, an emergency worker from San Francisco, caught in the storm of hurricane military and police of New Orleans. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. As we wrap up today's program, a very special thanks to the remarkable crew that produces Democracy Now! Every day. Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Maddie Harper, Susie Salami, Orlando Richards, our camera person, as well as Mike DeFilippo, our engineer, Uri Galed, our director, and Angela Alston, our technical director, Chris Zucker, our graphic designer. Our website is democracynow.org, where you can see all our coverage of Hurricane Katrina. On Monday, a rare extended interview with the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. Tell your friends. Tune in. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.